We've gone through pretty much, as you see the picture on the side there. I know that some of those, the writing on there, hard for some of you to see in the back, perhaps. But we've made our way, basically, through all of these various translations, beginning, so far as the English Bible is concerned, beginning with Wycliffe. And we saw the Coverdale Bible, went through that. We'll not go through all these again. The Matthew Bible. John Rogers, of course, is the real name of the fella, companion of Tyndale. And then the Great Bible. And that was the first Bible that was authorized to be read in all the churches, which was a very big deal, of course. And then the Geneva Bible, which became the most popular Bible of that time. And again, we talked about it being the Bible for the common man. And that's right. That's exactly what it was and continued to be for many years. And so we dealt with that. But all of these are just step towards where we are today. The Bishop's Bible, kind of, I don't know if I want to say that it was produced in rebellion, because the people who produced it were the ones in charge. So they were really rebelling. But they didn't like the popularity of the Geneva Bible with regard to being in the hand of the common man. And then, of course, I think we emphasized that with the Geneva Bible, there was a whole lot of personal notes that were anti-royalty, I guess you would say. They didn't like the way things were going, particularly with the bishops and the hierarchy that they had in place. And so a lot of personal notes there, plus a lot of Calvinistic notes in there that were disagreed upon by a lot of the people in the church, the bishops and others. So they came out with the Bishop's Bible. So then we get to the King James Bible. We talked briefly about the Catholic Bible, but now we come to the King James Bible, and so we've made our way all the way from down there all the way up to the King James. And the King James is probably the most popular Bible that there's ever been, really. Now, these days, we understand that the popularity of the King James really has decreased. In fact, most places I go and preach, very few people use the King James. And now still, in every congregation, I know some of you use the King James. I don't know exactly who. But in almost every local church, you still have several who use the King James, and that's wonderful. It's a great translation, and a very accurate translation. But most places I go, it's only a few people in the congregation. Like, most will either have many people, and this is changing a little bit. A lot of people would have the New American Standard. I suspect the New King James is maybe the most popular translation that I come across so far as people having that today. Very good translation. But the King James has sort of lost its popularity. But overall, through the years, it has been the most popular Bible. And as we have stated over and over, that it really, even to the standpoint of, you know, some people are fanatical about it. And when you get to being a King James only individual, then that's a problem. And that's why I mentioned that a lot with the King James, because it's the only translation that's like that. Like, there isn't anybody that I know of. Now, you have to be careful when you say anybody. But there's no one that I have ever heard that say, you know, if you don't use the ESV, you're going to hell. I doubt that. I don't know if anyone takes that position. But even some of these that go back, you know, I don't know that anyone takes that position except for with the King James Version. And there's people who literally believe if you don't use that Bible, you cannot make it to heaven, because every other translation is sinful And so you have to use that. But it is a very translation. It was for like 300 years after it was produced. We started last week talking about how it came about. King James, or James the Sixth, ascended to the throne, and he wanted more than anything else. He wanted peace in his kingdom, and that's what didn't exist. There were factions throughout England, and religious factions, and it wasn't like we have today, like a bunch of different denominations. The Church of England was the authorized church, but within that, you had these factions, and particularly the Puritans, who despised the idea that the church was kind of going along with what they viewed as Catholicism in parts of it, at least in their organization. They wanted to do away with the hierarchy completely and the bishops altogether. And so they despised that, as well as the pomp that they had in the Church of England, much like in the Catholic Church. So the Puritans really opposed that. And so when King James ascended to the throne, he knew that you had all of these factions and that they were warring with each other, and he wanted peace. In fact, he had received a letter that about 1,000 Puritan leaders had signed with grievances that they had with regard to the church. So that just added to his, you know, mentality that, boy, we have to do something about this. And so he arranged for there to be a meeting at a place called Hampton's Court Palace. And he called all of the different factions, representatives of them, at least a little bit. If I remember right, there were only 4 Puritans that were invited, because King James hated the Puritans. And he would always ridicule them for their positions. And in fact, when they called this meeting, the first day of the assemblies, those few Puritans weren't even invited. Like, that didn't sound like, you know, the whole meeting was about tolerance and unification. That didn't sound like he was getting off to a great start like that. And then they had a private meeting in which he did meet with the Puritans, but continued to just ridicule them. And they realized nothing good is going to come of this with regard to us. We're not going to have much of a say, much of a voice in any of this. And one of the leaders of the Puritans, a fellow by the name of John Reynolds, he was actually the president of Corpus Christi College in Oxford, and he was a Puritan. And so he raised the question to the king about a new translation. Because, and I'm not sure about this, but it would seem to me that he knew where the king stood with the present translations. He despised them. The Bishop Bible was just not a very good translation. And so there wasn't much to be said about that. Never really gained that much traction with regard to translations. And then the Geneva Bible, of course, he despised. He thought it was seditious because of those notes that were in it. I mean, so he didn't like them, and somehow Reynolds probably knew that, can't say that for sure, but probably knew that, in trying to get on the king's good side, because all he's doing is talking badly about him and those with him, and so he raises that question, and right away that pleases the king, because this is his opportunity to get rid of those translations he didn't like anyway. And so he authorizes then a new translation. And we might want to, as we think about the King James, first of all, we should know it is a revision. Basically, what they were doing was revising the Bishop's Bible. So right away, you have to think about something. If you're a King James only person, this something has to come to your mind. The King James is actually a revision of a revision. And it, when it's all said and done. But it was never really meant to be a new translation. This is actually the preface of the 1611 King James Version. And I put it up there exactly the way it is in the 1611 Version. So I know I misspell a whole lot of things a lot of times, but this isn't one of those times. This is exactly how it appears in that version. Truly, good Christian reader, we never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation. And so that was never their purpose, nor yet to make a bad one a good one. And that's referring to all of these translations that we have studied about and then just talked about, going back to Wycliffe and all the other ones, Tyndale's copy and all of that. They were all good translations. They all had flaws because they were translations. And all of these translations are produced by man, and man makes mistakes. So there isn't any such thing as a perfect translation. You should have that in your mind right now. There is no such thing as a perfect or inspired translation. None of them are inspired. They're translations. And that's why you always have, even going back to Tyndale's Bible, there were a lot of additions to them because they have to revise them from time to time and because there's mistakes in them. And so that's just the way it is. And so they weren't trying to make a new translation. They were trying to revise. Again, they were revising the Bishop Bible. But they were trying to make good ones better. And also, out of many good ones, to want to produce one principal good one. So they wanted, what their goal was, is to come up with a translation that everyone would accept. Which really had not, even though the Geneva Bible was real popular, it was popular with the common folks. As we have suggested, the bishops and others, they didn't so much like it. They wanted to produce a Bible that would be unifying, that everyone in the kingdom would like, that could be read publicly in the churches and privately in the home, that everyone appreciated. And that's really what they were after. So the king gave the authorization for that, and they started their work. It was about 1607 before they actually got started revising the bishop's Bible. And what they did, the king ordered a man who was the archbishop at the time, Richard Bancroft was his name, ordered him to get together a committee to get the job done. And so that's what he did. And what he did was he got six groups of people that and each group was made up of eight people, scholarly people, fine credentials. They knew what they were doing. And each group would have eight. And so there supposedly was 48, although you read different things. There were ultimately 54 men that were chosen. I read a couple of places, but only 48 or maybe 47 of them worked on the translation. But you had these six groups, and they went to three different places to do their revision. And they went to Cambridge. There two of the groups went to Cambridge, and they were to revise First Chronicles through Ecclesiastes, as well as the Apocrypha, for whatever that's worth, is what they were to do. And then another two groups went to Oxford, and they were to do Isaiah through Malachi in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, they were going to do the Gospels and Acts and Revelation, the Apocalypse. And so then the last two groups went to Westminster, and they were to do Genesis through 2 Kings, and then in the New Testament, Romans through Jude, and that would complete the Bible. And then after they did that, after they revised their section, they were to send their work to the other groups so that they could review it and approve it. And so they all did that. So that what it would produce then is something that wasn't from just one man or even a group of men, but it was the total group. And one of the things King James did, I've read where he wasn't a very wise man. I don't know a whole lot about King James, but I read he wasn't all that wise, but this was very wise. He made sure, the one instruction he gave them is don't put any personal notes in there. Like the Geneva Bible, because that's divisive. So he said, you can make a few notes if it's absolutely necessary, it pertains to the Greek or the Hebrew, to the original text, and you need something to explain, but no commentary, nothing like that. You know, and so all of that was to be left out. Now, what that actually did is it paved the way for the King James Version to be the first translation that was acceptable to everyone. It would have been impossible with those personal notes in there. Like the Geneva Bible would never be accepted by everyone because not everyone were Calvinists. and so that was the thing that they did. Of course, it was completed then in 611. So after several years, where was it, 4 years started in 07, so about 4 years, 7 years after that meeting at Hampton's court palace, the King James Version was complete. And now, whenever you start talking about translation, in fact, whenever you start talking about religion and religious things, you're not going to make everyone happy, are you? So there are a lot of people who didn't like the King James Version when it was complete. Like, it didn't get off to a very good start. It didn't sell very many copies. The common man still wanted the Geneva Bible. And the so-called clergy or whatever, they wanted the bishop's Bible. And so the King James Version got off to a slow start. And some people just despised it. There was a fella by the name of Hugh Broughton. And now, he was a brilliant Hebrew scholar. Brilliant. But he was left off the translation committee. And so he hated the translation. I wonder how he would have felt if he would have been on the translation committee. He probably would have loved it. But he hated it. And so he said that the ill-done work bred in him sadness that will grieve me while I breathe. That, like we'd say, as long as I'm alive. And he went on to say, I'd sooner be torn to pieces by wild horses than recommend such a Bible to England's churches. He just despised it. But my guess is only because he was left off the committee. And there are others who claimed that the translators were guilty of plagiarism because it was a lot like Tyndale's Bible. But remember, they really weren't thinking this is going to be something brand new. It was a revision. And revisions should look like something else. Of course, ironically, it wasn't a revision of Tyndale. It was a revision of the bishop's Bible, but they're all connected. If you've been paying attention as we've gone through the line, they're all connected. They do basically all trace back to Tyndale. That's why he's the father of the English Bible. But it didn't get off to a great start, but it really was a wonderful translation. This fellow says the Authorized Version gathered to itself the virtues of the long and brilliant line of English Bible translations. It united high scholarship with Christian devotion and piety. And so what you see here, those translators, they were ordered to, again, they were working off the bishop's Bible. But they were also told, you know, use everything you have available to you. So all those translations that we have already talked about in this study, they had access to them, and they were to use them whenever they were superior to Bishop's Bible. So it ended up being a really wonderful translation, a wonderful version of the Bible. And that was predictable for several different reasons. Number one, by the time that the King James started to be produced, the scholars knew a lot more of the original language of Hebrew and Greek than they did a couple of hundred years before that. And that, you know, we kind of talked about how that during the Renaissance and things, the education kind of came back in. And with regard to Hebrews, I mean, that's a difficult language. And even though we might say, you know, so-and-so, like Tyndale was a Hebrew scholar. He knew Hebrew. But, you know, there's just levels of that, degrees. And as time went on, scholars learned those languages better. And so the scholarship, the Greek scholarship and the Hebrew scholarship with regard to the King James was better than the previous Bibles that were put out. That's just natural. And so you see that. And then there was just, again, as I just stated, the education as a whole was better, was improving, coming out of the dark ages and all of that into the modern era. You know, you just had like when the King James was being made, that was Shakespeare's time. And you think that had an influence on how the King James was written, classical English? I mean, like, some people love the King James just because of the way it sounds. And it does. And if you grow up like that, you almost talk yourself into thinking it sounds biblical. Like, what does that mean? But a lot of people think that. So if you take the these and the thous and all of that out, and some people don't like the modern translation. They don't think it's spiritual enough, which makes no sense whatsoever. But the language, the classic English was a beautiful language, and it has a flow to it. Now, you know, we have to get, now some people don't like the King James for the very opposite because of the archaic words that are in it and everything, but you can't really argue against the beauty of the language. And so that, you know, that made it a wonderful translation. And then just, it was superior, as we already stated, because it had access to all these other Bibles that they could improve on. They could reach back and look at the great Bible and see what they got right and what was real good about it, or where it needed correcting, or Matthew's Bible and where it needed correcting. And that's a wonderful thing. Like I've often said with studies of difficult things like the Book of Revelation, whatever position you take on the Book of Revelation. Like Homer Haley is an individual who almost all preachers who sat at his feet take his position on the Book of Revelation, and he takes the late date, and then Foy Wallace takes the early date, and he kind of championed that it was written before AD 70 and is dealing with that. And well, you know, those men are scholarly and they did great work and presented their position pretty well. Well, now you have other people who have come along. I think Hark Rider has a book on Revelation. Some of you may have it. His book is, you read it, it's just almost like Homer Haley's book. And he sat at the feet of Homer Haley. But actually, when you read it, his is a little bit better. I wonder why. The author Ogden put out a wonderful book on Revelation with regard to the early date. If you ever wanted to see, what do they really think? Those brethren who think Revelation is dealing with the destruction of Jerusalem and all of that, what do they really think? I would recommend author Ogden. To me, his book is far superior than Foy Wallace's. And it's not because he probably wasn't as smart as Foy Wallace, but he had the benefit of looking at Wallace's book, seeing where he went right and where he went wrong, and improving. So you get the point. Hark Rider had the same thing. He could do the same thing with Haley's book. And so I'm saying in all of that, with the King James, with the translators, they could look at Wycliffe's work and say, well, you know, this needs improving. This isn't right over here in Tyndale's Bible. And so, of course, it's going to be superior. And that's the whole point of revisions. And it was a beautiful work. It was a very good translation. There's no question about that. But it had its flaws. Why did it have its flaws? It was a translation. At the end of the day, it was a translation. So they had to come up with some additions. In 1613, another edition of it came out, and there were 400 variations from the original. Like, I want to know, if you're King James only, what in the world do you do with that? That 2 years later, they had to revise it, and there was 400 differences. And then there were several different editions of the King James Version after that. And finally, in 1769, there's the edition that basically became the standard. If you look in your King James Bible now, it will probably, I'm not sure about every King James Bible, but it will probably reference the 1769 version. It'll probably say it's based on that. It became the standard over the years. But in that 1769 edition, there were 75,000 differences between that and the 1611. Now, again, minor, but you got to think about that when you're thinking, oh, the You know, the King James is inspired. Well, which edition are you talking about? And so it's just amazing to me that people are so fanatical. I think I told you before, I had someone follow me home from the radio program. They were so serious about that. And so it had its flaws. And one of the flaws that it had was the very thing that made it superior to other translations in its day. And that is, the scholarship with regard to the Greek and Hebrew continued to get better. So, you know, when you get down to the 19th century, they knew a little bit more about the original language than they did when the King James was being made. Like the Old Testament of the King James was based on the Masoretic text. That was just a fine text. Anything wrong with that? The problem is the scholars that were working on the King James didn't have the vocabulary, the Hebrew vocabulary that scholars developed later on, or even the Greek. There's so many little different nuances with regard to the Greek. Scholars improved over the years. So that was one reason that you basically needed a new translation to come along. But that wasn't the primary issue. The primary issue with the King James, the reason there was a need for modern translations, for more after the King James, as good as it was, again, it was better than all those other translations that we talked about. But the reason it needed more, because at the end of the day, it was based on a Greek text that was inferior. And there's just no way around that. I know King James only and others fight that left and right, but at the end of the day, there's just no way around that. And all we have to do is follow what we have studied so far. The King James, it was supposed to be a revision of the bishop's Bible. And so now you think, well, where did the bishop Bible come from? It was a revision of Matthew's Bible. It kind of skipped over the great Bible, went back to Matthew's Bible. And you remember Matthew's Bible, that was basically a combination between Tyndale's translation and Coverdale's translation. Coverdale filled in the gaps where Tyndale, he was arrested before he can hardly did any of the Old Testament. And Coverdale filled that in. And the Matthew Bible was a combination of that, but heavy with Tyndale's translation. Yeah, Adele. Right.
Did they ever change that? I never really checked that to see if they ever.
If they did, it would have been in the New King James. And I don't know if in the New King James, who has it? I know some of you have a New King James. Acts 12:4. Someone see if the New King James has Easter. They never changed it in the King James, so far as I know. Yeah. Yeah. But I'd be surprised if they didn't in the New King James, but they may not have. It says Passover. Okay. Yeah. 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 So, but, and a few of you who have King James, let me know I'm almost sure they hadn't changed in the King James. But that's just one flaw. Like I was talking to someone last week, maybe at the class or something, that somewhere, I don't even know where it is, but somewhere in the King James, it talks about a unicorn. Have you seen one of those lately? Well, the New King James has one. There was a unicorn sometime back in the Old Testament time. But it has flaws. But so does the ESV. I mean, the ESV is, you know, I use that translation because I like it. But it has flaws as well. It has one place where it, just like the King James, translates Hades, hell. And, I mean, why? Why in the world? In other places, they didn't make that mistake telling you they know the difference, but there you have it. And so, again, these are just translations. But the main thing is, the Greek text that they're working on, that they're based upon. And so you follow the line, and now Tyndale, of course, we remember, he used Erasmus's Greek text. Because Tyndale was the first one to translate from the original Greek into English. Tyndale made a translation from the Latin Vulgate. Right. So Tyndale was able to, Wycliffe is what I meant. But Tyndale was able to use the Greek text because Erasmus came up with that. And that's a wonderful step forward in the English Bible. But you remember, he only used 7 late century manuscripts. See, that's it. That's all Erasmus had access to. And they were very late. Now, got to get going because I really want to finish this. But at the end of the day, I'm skipping some steps here, but Erasmus's translation is basically became the Textus Receptus. I think there was an edition of his in 1633, and in the preface it had something of the line that now, the regard to the reader, now we have the text received by all. And so it's Latin. Sometimes Erasmus's text is called the received text, or the Textus Receptus. And that's what the King James is based upon. But when that was all done, they didn't have all of these things that we've already studied about. The great uncials that we talked about, how important they are. All of the papyri that go back to the second century, they didn't have any of that. They didn't have that. And so, I mean, it's clear to me that because they didn't have all of that, it would have been impossible for them to produce a text that was as close to the original as possible. Because they didn't have the most valuable, the earliest, and the most reliable, most scholars would say, the most reliable manuscripts that we now have. Remember, we now have over 5,000 of them. Erasmus used 7. And his text was the basis for the Textus Receptus, which the King James, the New Testament part of the King James, is based upon. See? And so you needed a new Greek text. And by the 19th century, we had 3 of them. New Greek text. Samuel Tregellis and Constantin von Tissendorf, you remember him? What did he produce? What did he find? Right. I knew Rick would answer that. And then Westcott and Hort, they came out with a text that really became the most popular one. It's called the New Testament in the original Greek. And that became the Greek text that many worked upon. But then there were more additions. But today, almost all of the modern translations are based upon the United Bible Society text and Nestle Aulin text. And those two different texts, the Nestle Aulin is from Germany and the United Bible Society from the United States, but they're basically identical. And you look in your Bible and see where it came from and in the notes and everything, most of your Bibles will say it's based upon those Greek texts. They're superior to the Textus Receptus simply because they have access to all of these manuscripts that they didn't have. So now you see the American Standard, the English Revision. I'm running out of time for these are the ones that came after the King James. First, there were groups of committee groups just like the King James. Two of the groups were British, and they were the main ones. They were doing the work, and then they were joined by some American scholars, after it was already in progress. So they produced the Bible. Took them 15 years as a whole to conclude. But the English translators didn't take any of the advice of the American scholars. They just made. They said, "Well, we'll put your feelings about it, and all your work. We'll put it in an appendix," and so they sort of compromised by doing that. And then they told the Americans, "But now, when you get back home, you can't. If we make an appendix of your suggestions, you can't make a translation for 14 years." And so they could. And then when the 14 years was up, then they did. And that, of course, produced then the American Standard version of 1909. Now, all of these things. Now, what do they have? Why are these superior in some ways? It's because they all these two go down to these manuscripts, as well as the papyri that we already talked about. And then when you get into the 20th century, I mean, just translation after translation came along in rapid order. There are many good books that you can read on translation. Ron Daly has an excellent book on translation. Wayne Jackson has one. If you wanted to get up into, how good these translations are, but all basically they're good because they use a superior Greek text going down to some of the oldest manuscripts that we have. That's the only reason why. Doesn't mean the King James isn't good. It was very accurate. But the other one, the later ones just got better because they had more to work with. Just simple as that. They just had more to work with. So all of those translations, now some of them, like the Living and up there the Message, those are paraphrases. And they, you have to be careful about them. They go by a source-by-source rendition instead of a word-by-word translation. And sometimes they get out there. But generally speaking, the latter ones are superior just because of the Greek text that they work with. So that's the English Bible. That's where we got it. A lot of people lost their lives so we could have it. But when it's all said and done, we can be sure we have the Word of God because of all these things that we study. Well, that's it for that. We'll start something new next week.